Certainly a question I want you to start asking yourself. Who's my one? You know, on the front side of your bulletin, this has been here for as long as I've been here, right underneath the date. Would you take a look at it for a moment? Because I want us to read it together out loud. The other day I tested our staff as we were having staff meeting. I said, what's the vision of our church? And they were able to say a few words that they were familiar with because you'll see those when you walk in, know, grow, and go. But that's really our mission of what we're how we're trying to accomplish. But what is our vision? Right underneath the date, would you read this out loud with me? Impacting the world by making disciples for God's glory. Which embedded in this is know and grow and go. At the bottom, you say we're going to know God. You know, in the middle, you're going to make disciples. That's growing together. And impacting the world is going everywhere intentionally. That's what we're about. But like so many things, we forget why we exist, why we're even called into a church body. Why did God save us? What are we doing? You know, so that's why I was so compelled to say, yes, I want to partner with our convention and focusing on who is your one. Now, I want to ask you a question. What comes to mind, what mental association do you have when I say, what is a Christian? Defining in your mind kind of what is a Christian. Now, let me prime the pump a little bit to get your mind start thinking about different things. So what mental associations do you have when I say, what is a politician? Oh, something just popped in your mind. Good, bad, and ugly, you know. All right. Well, what would you say, what is, in your mind, when I say a CrossFit fanatic? All right, you got something in mind. All right, for some of you, this will be different among everybody. What comes to mind when I say the term a millennial? No laughing, no boasting. What comes in your mind when I say the term Star Wars? Did you have in your mental image some of the newer stuff, or did you go back to the 70s and think about the good stuff? Oh, I'm sorry, the original. Yeah, we have these mental associations. What comes to your mind when you think of an Alabama fan? All right, no snickering. What comes in your mind when you think of a Georgia fan? What comes to your mind when you think of a soccer fan here in Atlanta? Yeah, some is positive. Some is like, man, they are the craziest people on the planet. So we have mental associations that we connect. I mean, everybody here probably had some mental image in their mind. So when I ask you the question, what comes into mind when I say Christian? You have some thought of what that may be. Some of you may even say, yes, I am a Christian. Some of you may be certain you're not a Christian. Maybe you're open to it, but you're not sure yet if you want to become a Christian, but you have in your thoughts what a Christian is. Barna did a research study a few years ago. It revealed that the majority of people outside of the church, those who aren't associated with church or they used to be and now no longer, this is how they think of Christians. 91% of them think of Christians as anti-homosexual. That's the first thing that comes to mind. Some think of judgmental. 87% said judgmental. 85% said they're hypocritical. That was the mental image they had. 78% said they're old-fashioned. Others said they were too political. 72% said they were out of touch with reality. 70% of those who don't go to church said Christians are insensitive to other people. 68% simply said, Christians, they're boring. That's the mental association of what a Christian is in our world. Is there any wonder why churches are not being flocked to and Christ isn't being followed? Because whatever they've seen of what they consider Christians, it's not attractive to them. There's nothing about Christianity that seems to draw them. And perhaps in so many ways, it's not Jesus that they're rejecting, it's the Christianity that's been displayed in our world that they're rejecting. And quite frankly, I reject many of those things too. Did you know that the first Christians, the first followers of Jesus, didn't even call themselves Christians? That it wasn't a term that they used for one another. They weren't saying, hey, are you a Christian? I got my Christian bumper sticker. It's not anything that they would even consider. Actually, in reality, the term Christian was only used three times in the Bible. The entire Bible, only three times the word Christian used. And that was used in a derogatory way. They would look at Christian people and say, oh, you're Christians. You're little Christ. You're running around like Jesus was. Well, we killed him and he's done. So it was always in a negative perspective. You know what Christians actually call themselves? Same thing that Jesus would call them. He called them disciples. 281 times in the New Testament, the term disciple is used. Now, I'm not trying to propose that you're going to throw away the term Christian. You're going to go to work tomorrow and say, hey, I'm no longer a Christian. That's not necessarily my point. What I'm saying is that sometimes our words and our definitions get so slanted that perhaps we ought to go back to being familiar with God, what God has called us to. And he's called us to be disciples. So perhaps we need to understand what a disciple is. A disciple is a follower of Christ. Someone who wants to learn from Christ, become like Christ. Let me give you some examples. A disciple is one who follows a teacher so closely that he becomes just like his teacher. So the concept, the word disciple actually will expose the fact that many who claim to be Christians are not actually disciples of Jesus. They just have a label that they've attached to themselves. Today I want us to be in the text of Matthew chapter 4. If you've got a Bible with you, pick that up. Matthew chapter 4, we're only going to look at a few verses, at verse 18 through 22. If you don't have a Bible with you, that's all right. We have a red Bible in the pew rack right in front of you. And you can turn to page 809. So in Matthew chapter 4, verse 18 and following, let me just read this section in its entirety for us. While walking by the Sea of Galilee, Jesus saw two brothers, Simon, who is called Peter, Andrew, his brother, casting a net into the sea, for they were fishermen. And he said to them, follow me, and I will make you fishers of men. Immediately they left their nets and followed him. And going on from there, he saw two other brothers, James, the son of Zebedee, and John, his brother, in the boat with Zebedee, their father, mending the nets, and he called them. Immediately they left their boat and their father and followed him. Now that's an amazing story. But do you find it a little odd? These fishermen, rugged fishermen, are out there fishing. Some guy in a robe comes up to them and says, hey, leave it all, follow me. And they immediately followed. Now, if someone showed up, Andre, if somebody showed up, you're out there doing your work, and some guy in a robe just comes up to you and says, hey, Andre, drop it, let's go, let's follow. You don't know him. Would you just leave your employment right there? Seems a little odd. How many of you, if some guy knocked in your door and said, hey, I'm here for you, let's go. There was no pre-warning. You don't really know the guy very well. Maybe you've heard of him, but this guy calls you away. That's odd to me. It's almost like, you know, go back to a Star Wars illustration. It's like he did some kind of, you know, Jedi mind trick. Come follow me. Yes, we will follow you. No, that's not it at all. You know, sometimes when you read the scripture, you ought to read a little slower and put yourself in the sandals of the people in the story and go, would I do that? Some just guy walks up to me, yeah, I just follow everybody. Don't you teach your children not to follow strangers? They just come up and say, follow me. Oh, yeah, come on, let's go. Oh, yeah, well, why not? No, that's unusual. So to understand why they did what they did, you have to understand the background, the historical background of this. And sometimes I know we reject history and kind of the boring stuff we think, but in reality, it gives you a better perspective of what's happening here. The fishermen were Jewish. Every Jewish boy at the age of 5 went through Torah school. Every one of them. They got to Torah school, and what Torah is, the Torah is the first 5 books of the Old Testament, you know, Genesis through Deuteronomy. And they would learn it. They would memorize it. In reality, the first couple of days of class, is my understanding, is the boys would get there, and many of them came out of very poor homes. And so they would put honey on their tongue as they read the book of Genesis to them. First time those boys had ever tasted something sweet. And if you'll listen as we read, we'll give you more of it. Oh, give me some more of that. You understand? Kind of, you know, encourage some of you teachers that have worked with children. If I'll just give you a piece of candy, you'll listen to me. Danny is the master of that, by the way, I've heard. Is Danny in here? He's on our security team, so maybe you step down. So they would give them that. So these Hebrew boys would go to Torah school. They'd learn the first five books of the Old Testament, and they would get to taste the honey. They would do this for 5 years. By the time they were age 10, those boys knew the Torah. But the best students, top 20% of those students, got to advance and continue on in the school, where the rest of them, the 80%, were said, you really didn't make the cut. You didn't really understand it. We don't see a lot of worth in you to advance. So therefore, you go back to your families and you learn the profession of your family. Fisherman, tax collector, whatever that may be. And so it got down to just a few. Well, by the time they reached age 17, the boys who continued on to the school, there was another cut. And if they wanted to go on and make a career out of the religious studies, your next step would be to find a rabbi, meaning teacher, that you admired and apply to become the rabbi's Talmid, a Hebrew disciple. Now, I want you to get a perspective of this. In our generation, if we said, all right, let's put all of our children in like a Christian school, they'll learn all of this. By the time they're 10, we'll see if they make it, and then we'll cut some of them out. Listen to me. There was a huge desire among every family and every child, because this was the greatest profession on the planet, to be in the religious sect, to be able to follow God. I mean, there was no basketball and rock stars that they were trying to follow. This was the top. And so you wanted to be in the last few percentage, where most of them did not. But if you made it, you would run after a rabbi and be his Talmid, his disciple. And when you found one, you would go and you would sit at his feet requesting to learn. Well, that rabbi would examine that young man. He would question him to see if he was worthy to be his disciples. And rabbis did not always accept those who applied. These rabbis would choose the smartest, the most talented to be their disciples. They also chose young men they believed would become just like them. Not just to know what they know, but to do what they do. To take on the same mannerisms, to answer in the same way. They were making mini-me's, if you will. I want somebody I see so moldable that they'll become just like me. And they rejected most. The highest compliment you could give to a Talmid in that day was, his dust gets all over you. Meaning, as that rabbi would walk, you were so close that the dust that he would stir up would get all over you, and you'd begin to smell like he smells. You'd begin to walk like he walks. Everything about you mimics who he is. Now, in Jesus' day, there was really a rare form of a rabbi. Not all rabbis reached this level, but there was a rare form of rabbi who possessed a characteristic that the Jewish people called a shmiha. You learn shmiha? A shmiha. Would you say that's kind of a fun word to say? Shmiha. Shmiha is Hebrew for authority. So when a rabbi had an incredible sense of the scriptures, they had a command of it, a masterful command of it, that they were able to give insights and say this particular phrase, you've heard it said, but I say to you. That means they had shmiha. They had an authority that people listened to. And based on historical records, there was only about 12 individuals, 12 rabbis that ever reached to the level of shmiha in the first century. So when someone in your presence was the shmiha, the authority rabbi, you gave them listening. You watched. You wanted to know what they had to say. To be regarded as a rabbi with shmiha, there had to be incredible evidence that you could perform a miracle, Shmiha had to be officially conferred on you by two other rabbis, also with Shmiha, which they didn't give very often. This was a very exclusive club. Now, I want you to go back to Matthew chapter 4 and understand. When Jesus walks up to these young men, this was the Jesus that at 12 years old, when he was in the temple, the religious scribes were sitting around this little 12-year-old. Why? Because he had extra insight and authority. He had some Shmiha all over him. You know, in Matthew chapter 7, just a few chapters from this, where Jesus would frequently say, "You have heard it said, but I say to you," he says in this particular verse, in chapter 7, verse 28, "And when Jesus finished these sayings, the crowds were astonished at his teaching, for he was teaching them as one who had Shmiha," one who had authority, and not as the typical scribes or Pharisees. In Luke chapter 20, verse 2, the chief priest and the scribes said to him, "Tell us by which Shmiha, tell us by which authority you speak these things. And who is it that gave you this Shmiha?" The person who had to give it to him had to be someone who also had Shmiha. You know, and Jesus had in two different places in the New Testament, he didn't necessarily need human authority. He got God's authority. God spoke to him at his baptism. "This is my son whom I am well pleased." What greater commendation and review could you get than that? So in considering this, when he walks up to these fishermen, he wasn't just some guy who said, "Why don't you leave fishing and follow me?" They knew, based on his own presence, this was a Shmiha. Now I want you to notice in the text, but look at verse 18. This is where I'm going to take you into a few places here in this chapter. In verse 18, it says, "While walking by the Sea of Galilee, he saw two brothers, Simon, who was called Peter, and Andrew, his brother, casting a net into the sea, for they were fishermen." I want you to notice here that Jesus, this new rabbi with Shmiha, chooses Peter and Andrew, and the fact that they were fishermen shows you what? They didn't make the cut. Out by 10 years old. And he's walking up to them. Here's the first thing I want you to notice. That Jesus doesn't choose the best. He chooses the willing. When he's calling people to himself, he doesn't go after those who made the cut, those who have proved themselves, those that had all kinds of ability. He goes to those who are merely willing to receive and to follow. They were the B team. I want you to let that sink in for a second. When Jesus chooses his squad to build his movement, he chose the B team. So, of course, when they heard the call, they immediately went. I want you to imagine if perhaps you have some sport that you really like, or there's some profession you want, you know, and you're not quite there, and maybe you've tried out, and you've been cut from the team. You never even made it to the practice squad. I mean, it just never was good. Maybe you've tried out for some kind of position, and they continue to drop you off. But then the owner of the company, the coach of the team, walks up to you at a local Starbucks or sees you in line at Walmart, and he walks up and says, "Hey, I want you to be on the team. Come on." You notice he's not calling you because of your ability, just because he wants you. Just because she wants you. It has nothing to do with your ability. God doesn't go after those who have all kinds of ability. He just goes after those who have some availability. He doesn't call the equipped. He always equips the called. I love how here, when Peter and Andrew are being selected, and there have others that are come along, it has nothing to do with how great they are. It has to do with how great he is and what he can do through them. I think we need to stop giving our excuses of why we're not involved in God's mission. Too many times we say, "Well, what can I do? I mean, I'm nobody. I didn't make the team. I didn't go to seminary. I didn't do all these things. And it's not that question at all. If you consider what Jesus did with Peter and Andrew, they had been cut out of seminary school. They weren't making it. They were just fishermen. And God just walks up to them and says, but it has nothing to do with all of that. It has to do with what I can do through you. So stop asking what you can do and just start asking what I can do through you if you are willing and available. What a powerful call to our lives. We give excuses. We look down upon what is possible because we only look in the